This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines. Iran says it will not admit a new Swedish ambassador over the desecration of the Holy Quran in the European country. Passengers across Britain facing travel disruption as railway workers go on a new strike. And North Korea carries out fresh missile tests as tensions mount with the US and its regional allies. Welcome to World News from Tehran. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, Egypt and the UAE join a chorus of condemnation of the latest desecration of the Holy Quran in Sweden. Egypt has called for the punishment of those behind the insulting act. The UAE has summoned the Swedish chargé d'affaires to Abu Dhabi, and Iran says it will not admit a new Swedish ambassador.
The Swedish ambassador's term in Tehran has ended, and according to the president's order, until the Swedish government takes a serious action over the desecration of the Quran, we will not accept the new Swedish ambassador. Also, the Iranian ambassador will not be sent to Sweden as announced earlier.
Earlier, Emir Abdullahian warned of the dire consequences of the act of desecration. He issued the warning in a phone call with his Swedish counterpart, Tobias Billström. Emir Abdullahian called on Stockholm to stop promoting violence and sowing discord. He also dismissed as unacceptable all acts of sacrilege against holy books and religious sanctities including under the pretext of freedom of speech. The top diplomat demanded prosecution of the person responsible for the move. Billström, in turn, condemned the sacrilegious act. He said the Swedish police had only issued a permit for assembly and had not authorized insulting the Holy Book of Muslims. Iranians across the country took to the streets after Friday prayers to strongly condemn the recent sacrilege of the Holy Quran. In Sweden, a huge crowd also gathered in front of the Swedish embassy in Tehran, demanding the expulsion of its ambassador. Gisu Mishahmadi tells us more.
Iranians from all walks of life once again out on the streets, chanting slogans and using the strongest terms to express their anger.
Protesters rallied in the Iranian capital, Tehran, after the Friday prayers, along with a number of other major cities across the country, to condemn the desecration of the Holy Quran.
The protesters also called on the foreign ministry to cut ties with Sweden. This is the second time in less than a month that an Iraqi refugee in Stockholm has committed the sacrilegious act with protection from Swedish police.
No one should allow themselves to insult our religious beliefs. This is absolutely unacceptable.
We just had to take part in this rally to get our voices heard.
The Swedish government has allowed this to happen, and we are here to express our anger.
We are here for our holy book, for our religion.
Later in the day, protesters once again gathered outside the Swedish embassy in Tehran, demanding the ambassador to leave the country.
It's the second time this is happening, so we should definitely show a stronger reaction.
Iranians are very well aware of the consequences of such blasphemous acts. That is why you see so many of us here.
We will not stop until the Swedish ambassador leaves our country.
This is exactly what we want our officials to do. The foreign ministry has to expel the ambassador, and we will continue these rallies until he leaves.
The Iranian foreign ministry summoned the Swedish ambassador to Tehran on Thursday, but the protesters are now calling for the expulsion of the ambassador. They are planning another rally in front of the foreign ministry in the coming days, demanding Iran to cut ties with Sweden. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
Now, another blasphemous act against the Holy Quran has taken place in Europe, this time in Denmark. The desecration has sparked condemnations from Muslim countries, including Iran and Iraq. Tehran says the Danish government is accountable to punish those who insulted the Quran on Friday outside the Iraqi embassy in Copenhagen. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani says Denmark should have prevented such occurrence, adding Islamic nations are waiting for practical measures from the European state. Kanani underlined the need for unity among Muslims and all followers of divine religions to effectively confront any desecration of sanctities. Iran's neighbor Iraq has called on the international community to stand against such crimes that violate peace and coexistence around the world. Baghdad says such blasphemies do not embody freedom of speech and the right to hold the protest. Israeli forces have shot dead yet another Palestinian teenager in the occupied West Bank. 18-year-old Fawzi Mukhalfa was fatally shot when regime forces opened fire on his car. The shooting took place in Sebastia village in Nablus. Israeli forces also killed another Palestinian during a raid on a village north of Ramallah on Friday. Several Palestinians were also injured there. The regime's military raids in the occupied West Bank have grown deadlier under the far-right cabinet of Benjamin Netanyahu, which took power on December 29, 2022. The regime has killed at least 200 Palestinians since then. Israel's President Isaac Herzog has visited the United States amid rising condemnation of the Israeli regime over its treatment of Palestinians. The visit has proved to be a controversial one, as several of the U.S. lawmakers boycotted Herzog's address to Congress. They argue that Herzog's visit to the United States legitimizes the Israeli regime's brutality against Palestinians.
The Israeli President Isaac Herzog has visited the United States and was welcomed by the U.S. establishment, including President Biden and senior congressmen. But a number of U.S. lawmakers, frustrated with the racist policies of the Israeli regime toward Palestinians, boycotted Herzog's speech to the U.S. Congress. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, Jamal Bowman, Cori Bush, and Nydia Velazquez, along with Senator Bernie Sanders, skipped the address. Ilhan Omar, an African-American congresswoman, was the first to make such a decision. In a tweet, Omar said the invitation, which comes during the deadliest year for Palestinians in the West Bank history, sends a wrong signal at a wrong time.
So let's just begin by setting up the context that this is 2023 in the aftermath of the legacy human rights organizations, Israeli human rights organizations, UN committees, UN agencies, as well as multiple scholars and independent investigations have all concluded that Israel oversees an apartheid regime.
The Israeli regime barred Omar and Palestinian-born Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib from visiting the occupied territories in 2019 over their support for Palestinian rights and membership in the Anti-Israel Caucus. Rights advocates have said that Herzog's visit has been a boost to the unquestionable U.S. support for Israel at a time when many of them are asking Biden to pressure Netanyahu's cabinet to end abuses against Palestinians.
And let's just get this record straight here. This is not something that's made up. The United Nations Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, Israel's own largest human rights organization, B'Tselem, all agree that Israel is an apartheid state. To assert otherwise, Mr. Speaker, in the face of this just body of evidence, is an attempt to deny the reality and to normalize violence of apartheid. Israel is an apartheid state. The government is deeply problematic in the way that they are proceeding in the structure of oppression.
The boycott has signaled increasing tensions among Democrats over the unwavering support of the U.S. establishment toward Israel. Tensions between House Democrats reached a boiling point after Pramila Jayapal, chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, described Israel as a racist state while speaking at a conference in Chicago.
I want you to know that we have been fighting to make it clear that Israel is a racist state, that the Palestinian people deserve self-determination and autonomy, that the dream of a two-state solution is slipping away from us.
Now, 2023 has been a deadly and brutal year for Palestinians. Just weeks ago, Israel ended its extensive military raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. Palestinians also face frequent violent attacks by Israeli settlers. Internally, the Israeli regime is facing a crisis over Prime Minister Netanyahu's right-wing cabinet and his contentious judicial overhaul plan.
Following the remarks of Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, a resolution was approved by the U.S. House of Representatives that voiced support for the Israeli regime. The resolution turned a blind eye to the crimes that were recently committed by Israeli troops in the occupied West Bank and ignored frequent settler violence against the people of Palestine. Israeli settlers also frequently attack Palestinian towns and villages under the protection of the Israeli military forces. Israel has been practicing an apartheid regime, a system of extreme racial segregation of people against Palestinians since 1948. That year, the regime claimed existence across Palestine after a Western-backed war, during which tens of thousands of Palestinians were forcibly expelled from their homes, villages were depopulated, and thousands were killed.
The United States is not just a bystander here. The United States is complicit and a pillar of Israeli apartheid in its provision on unequivocal financial, diplomatic, and military support. That but for that support, Israel could not sustain this regime, which is not surprising at all, because the U.S. was the last pillar to fall, the last domino to fall in sustaining apartheid in South Africa, where it had to fall in line with everyone else. But during apartheid South Africa and the international campaign against it during that regime's tenure, the United States issued the most vetoes within the Security Council to protect apartheid.
The world's prominent rights groups have already raised the alarm that the occupying regime is morphing into an apartheid system that gives Palestinians second-class status and is designed to maintain Zionist hegemony from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea. The Israeli oppression of Palestinians has witnessed a sharp rise under Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's extremist coalition cabinet, which is composed of far-right Zionist parties that oppose Palestinian statehood and support the expansion of settlements. Internally, the Israeli regime has also witnessed growing rifts and fragmentations, and the right-wing cabinet of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is pushing ahead with his controversial judicial overhaul plans. Just days ago, hundreds of reservists held a protest rally in Tel Aviv and vowed to no longer report for duty in protest against Netanyahu's proposed judicial changes. Protest organizers believe the increasing involvement of reservists would be a game-changer that could make Netanyahu scrap his scheme. The drive by Netanyahu's far-right cabinet to change the judiciary system and to strip the Supreme Court of some of its powers has sparked unprecedented protests in Israel since January.
Turning elsewhere now, Britons are facing travel chaos as thousands of railway staff go on a new strike over pay, job cuts and working conditions. The 24-hour strike by the workers involving 14 train companies has either disrupted or limited services to commuters. A number of train operators have been forced to reduce their regular timetable. Passengers have been warned to check before travel. The strike has forced many Brits to use cars and buses amid the summer holiday getaway when roads are expected to be congested. Saturday's industrial action is part of three strikes this month. Members of railway unions had walked off their jobs on Thursday. The next one is set for July 29. Trade unions are locked in negotiations with the government over wages and working conditions. The UK has seen similar strikes across other sectors in recent months. Britain's ruling party has lost two parliamentary seats in Thursday's by-elections, regarded as a litmus test for the premiership of Rishi Sunak. The Conservatives lost to the Liberal Democrat Party in Somerton and Frome, southwest England. The Tories also lost their majority in the northern constituency of Selby and Ainsty, where the opposition Labour Party won the seat. The ruling party did manage to retain its seat in a West London constituency. The seat was left empty after former Prime Minister Boris Johnson resigned as a Member of Parliament in June. The results of the three by-elections were announced as incumbent Sunak is facing division within his party. The Tories have been facing growing public discontent over a series of scandals as well as high inflation. Our correspondent in London, Saeed Poreza, tells us how big of a blow the results of the UK by-elections are to the ruling Conservative Party.
Yeah, but generally speaking, when you put these two results together, the results for Labour and Liberal Democrat, there is a lot of disillusionment. And as I said, there was tactical voting. But what it means is that it reeks of the kind of loss that the Conservatives suffered in the 1990s. But as we heard the Prime Minister say earlier today, Rishi Sunak, that, you know, the results show that perhaps the general election results are not a done deal. But the fact remains that this is still a huge blow to the Conservatives. Definitely these results are sending a shiver down the necks of many, many Conservative MPs in areas that they control, because the fear, of course, is among them that come the 2024 general election, it's only a year away, give or take, a lot of the other constituencies where the Conservatives hold the seats might follow suit and vote for other parties. So Mr. Sunak, the Prime Minister, may take cover in the fact that they have managed to hold on to the Uxbridge seat, where his former boss was in charge before he quit, but that is definitely little comfort.
Turning elsewhere now, the Russian president says Ukraine's military counteroffensive is failing despite military and financial support from Western countries.
Today, it is clear that the Western curators of the Kiev regime are clearly disappointed with the results of the so-called counteroffensive, which the current Ukrainian authorities have been loudly promoting in previous months. In any case, there are no results yet.
Addressing a Russian Security Council meeting, Putin said that as a result of what he called suicidal attacks, the Ukrainian armed forces have suffered extensive losses, with tens of thousands of soldiers killed. The Russian president added that neither the supply of weapons nor the presence of foreign mercenaries and advisers have helped Kiev. He said the U.S. wants to weaken Europe by fanning the flames of conflict. The Russian president has suggested that European public opinion and even European elites are turning against the endless waste of money and effort on behalf of U.S. hegemonic interests. Since Russia launched the war in Ukraine last February, Western countries have been providing extensive military support to Kiev. The U.S. has been Ukraine's largest military supporter with over $40 billion worth of aid. And the Ukrainian president has dismissed the country's ambassador to the United Kingdom just days after the envoy publicly criticized him. A presidential order said Vadim Prostenko had also been removed as Ukraine's representative to the International Maritime Organization. The order did not detail the reason for Prostenko's removal or the person replacing him. In an interview last week, Prostenko said President Volodymyr Zelensky's remarks about the UK Defense Secretary were unhealthy. Prosteko said there was some sarcasm in Zelensky's comments that he would wake up each morning and thank the UK Defence Secretary. This after Wallace, the UK's Defence Secretary, said Ukraine's allies wanted to see gratitude and that the UK was not Amazon delivery service when it comes to weapons delivery. That brings an end to World the News for this hour. Thank you for sticking around.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Zionist regime forces and settlers have expelled a Palestinian family from their home in the occupied old city of Al-Quds based on an Israeli regime court order. The order said the family who have lived in their home for 7 years should be removed so settlers could take over. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, Israeli regime police expelled a Palestinian family from their home of more than 7 years in Al-Quds Old City recently. The Qais Sub Laban family's apartment is now occupied by Jewish settlers after an Israeli regime court order. The court ruling ended the protected tenancy of Nora Qais, 68, and Mustafa Sub Laban, 72. Ajit Songay, the head of the UN Human Rights Office in the West Bank and Gaza, said that the eviction of the couple may amount to forcible transfer, a grave breach of the Geneva Conventions, and a war crime. The Human Rights Office added that international humanitarian law prohibits the Zionist regime from imposing its own laws in occupied territory, including East Al-Quds, which includes the use of Israeli regime laws to evict Palestinians from their homes. The UN body noted that the expulsion of the Qais Sub Laban family is part of a broader effort to force Palestinians out of the eastern sector of Al-Quds, which was occupied by the Zionist regime in 1967 and annexed in violation of international law. Some 150 Palestinian families in the city, around 1,000 individuals, are threatened with eviction and forcible transfer due to discriminatory laws and state collusion with settler groups, the UN added. An organization linked to Ataret Kohanim, a right-wing settler group, had been seeking possession of the Qais Sub Laban property since 2010, but the battle over the home has been ongoing for 45 years, as the Zionist regime has attempted to seize it for Jewish settlement. It is hardly the first time that an Israeli regime court has ruled in favor of settlers seeking the eviction of Palestinians from their Al-Quds homes. Palestinians have long pointed out that the Zionist regime's judiciary, which protesters have been seeking to protect from Benjamin Netanyahu's overhaul, has rubber-stamped violations against their rights. The Zionist regime settlers already resided in other apartments in the building from which the Qais Soblaban family was removed recently. Ahmad Soblaban told the Electronic Intifada in 2015 that his grandparents moved into the home in 1953, renting it from a Jordanian body established to administer property taken from or abandoned by Jews in the West Bank before the fabricated regime of Israel was declared in 1948. Their lease allowed for the family's tenancy to be protected as long as Nora Soblaban, who was born in the home, and her heirs lived there. When the fake regime of Israel occupied the eastern sector of Al-Quds in 1967, the property fell under the authority of the regime. Since then, the Zionist regime has endeavored to revoke the Qais Soblaban's protected tenancy status and push the family out. The two other Palestinian families were forced from the same building in late 1970s, and the Israeli settlers who moved in eventually blocked the Qais Soblaban family from accessing the property. They lived in another neighborhood for 16 years until a court order allowed them to access their home again. The family's troubles began anew in 2010 when the Zionist regime's guardian of absentee property transferred ownership of the home to an entity that eventually became the Kollel Galicia Trust. That trust has deep ties to Ataretz Kohanim, a settler group dedicated to colonizing the Muslim quarter of Al-Quds Old City, a goal shared by the regime. A 1970 law allows Israelis to reclaim property owned by Jews before the fabricated regime of Israel was declared in 1948. Many of the properties that settlers are seeking to seize under this law house Palestinians who fled or were expelled from the western sector of Al-Quds in 1948. By contrast, the regime prohibits Palestinians from recovering vast amounts of land and property seized during, before, and after the Zionist regime's founding. Foreign diplomats had visited the Qais Soblaban family ahead of their forced eviction, but absent any meaningful pressure on Israel, international concern does little to protect Palestinians in a situation of total impunity. Recently, the European Union stated that we regret the decision by the Israeli authorities following a court decision to evict the Qais Soblaban family from the home they occupied since 1953. The British consulate in Al-Quds said that it was appalled by the eviction, adding that such actions cause unnecessary suffering and risk inflaming intercommunal tensions. The consulate employed a familiar rhetorical device whereby it condemns an Israeli regime action because it might inflame tensions rather than explicitly saying that it violates international law, thus compelling the UK to seek accountability. Palestinians described the expulsion of Qais Soblaban family as a second Nakba, or a continuation of the ethnic cleansing of Palestine around the time of the Zionist regime's establishment. In the meantime, Wafa News Agency reported the Zionist regime forces recently broke into the Dar al-Arabi child school in the occupied city of Al-Quds and claimed they were looking for a wanted Palestinian. Sources said that the troops inspected the school before withdrawing without detaining anyone. Meanwhile, Israeli regime forces detained two Palestinians from Al-Quds.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. For the second time in a month, the Swedish police has granted permission for the desecration of the Holy Quran in Stockholm. As a result, anger is now boiling over in the Muslim world with calls for expulsion of Swedish envoys from Islamic countries and the boycotting of Swedish products by Muslims. Sweden says it opposes a sacrilegious act, but has given the green light for it in the name of freedom of speech. But are the Western countries really committed to providing all peoples with a right to freely express their beliefs, or is it just another political tool for advancing their policies? Let's discuss that in tonight's Spotlight with our guests. Matthew Taib, founder of Al-Qaim Seminary, joining us from Rome. And historian and journalist Brecht Jonkers joining us from Hasselt, Belgium. Well, gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Taib in Rome. Share with us your perspective on what has happened in Sweden over the past month. Iran's foreign minister just recently has warned that the desecration of the Holy Quran will have dire consequences and called on Sweden to stop promoting violence and sowing discord. Why would Swedish officials allow such an act to happen again?
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Thank you for having me. I think it's not the first time that we see this type of actions for burning Quran or other holy books in different parts of the world by the extremists. I think we need to realize the reality of what's going on. On one side, we have a book that we know as the holy book, the book of God. On the other side, we have certain individuals who are burning these books, and also certain governments, certain regimes that are protecting them and giving them full support. Okay, we might not be able to know who those people are who are burning the book, but we know what these books are. We've been reading these books for thousands of years. We have the Holy Quran between us for 1,400 years now. So let's see how Quran introduces itself to people. Let's see what the teachings of the Quran is, so that by knowing what the Quran is, we get to know who those people who are burning the Holy Quran are, and those governments, those politicians who are giving them green lights to do this, to do such actions. So if we refer to the Holy Book, if we refer to the Holy Quran, I think we get to understand what this book really is. Quran, in the first pages of it, introduces itself as the book of guidance. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, alif lam mim dhalik al-kitab, la rayba fi hudan lil-muttaqin. This is a book, there's now no doubt in it. If you read it, you can argue even one single point of it. There's always answers for every single point in it. And it's a guidance, it's a book of guidance for the God-weary, for those pious people. The second thing, let's take a look at the teachings of the Holy Quran. Quran number one, teaches justice to people. Quran is a book of justice. In more than 22 ayahs, in more than 22 verses, Quran is talking about the philosophy of justice. Quran is talking about the reason why prophets were sent down to us, and it was there to uphold justice. Quran is telling us that if we want to judge between people, we have to be just. Quran is telling us that we have to fight for a government that can bring justice for people, and we need to establish a government, the final and universal government of the Savior that will bring justice to people. So Quran is a book of justice. All over this book, when you read this book, you see it's talking about justice. Second, Quran is a book of freedom. Quran is telling us, is telling those who read this book, not to accept the authority and the power of anyone but God. Quran says you are free. You were born free. You were created free. And you have your freedom. Even this book as a book of guidance, even this book as a book of God, Quran says, I am telling you what the right path is. If you want, you can choose it. If you don't want it, choose other ways. إِنَّا هَدَيْنَاكُمُ السَّبِيلَ أَمَّا شَاكَرًا وَأَمَّا كَفُورًا. We just show you the right way. We just show you what the destination and what the way, what the path towards the destination is. We won't force you. So this is another point. Quran is a book of freedom. Quran highly values the freedom of people. The second thing, if you want to go over the teachings of this book so that we know, we may be able to know who the enemies of this book are. Quran is a book of virtue. Quran is a book of morality. In many of its verses, Quran is inviting people to worship only one God. And the second thing that Quran says after worshiping only one God, which is God, the Almighty, he says, وَبِالْوَالِدَيْنِ إِحْسَانًا. You have to be kind to your parents.
All right, let's bring in Mr. Jonkers in on the discussion. Breck, the Sacrilegious Act in Sweden, as we know, has drawn condemnation from across the Muslim world. Iranians, earlier, we saw them staging a sit-in outside the Swedish embassy demanding the expulsion of the Swedish ambassador. Similar rallies were held in capital cities of Iraq, Pakistan, and Lebanon as well. The renowned Egyptian university has chimed in saying Al-Azhar University has called for boycotting Swedish products. Several Muslim states have summoned the Swedish envoys. Was the international backlash from the previous incident not a big enough sign for Sweden, or was it just ignored on purpose?
Well, I think they definitely chose to ignore it. They could have done the reasonable thing, and that is pulling their hands off of the situation. The Swedish government could have said, yeah, okay, we made a mistake. There was definitely a problem made here with this one rabidly Islamophobic person who burned the Quran. Of course, the problem is that even the first instance of Quran desecration that happened in Sweden this month happened with explicit permission from the Swedish government. Indeed, the Stockholm said in advance that this completely pre-planned and known priorly organized event of Quran desecration would be allowed to pass without anyone stopping him, because of the fact, quote unquote, because of the freedom of speech policies that Sweden claims to have, and now they have done it again, despite the fact that the desecration has drawn the ire of so many Muslims, of millions of Muslims, about I think almost every single Muslim of the over 1.5 billion Muslims that there are is angry about this. But the problem is that the Swedish government, I believe, just doesn't care. And in fact, it's not just that they don't care. It is actually part, I believe, of a far larger and a far more, I would call it sinister, plan. And that is, they use the ire of Muslims, the anger of Muslims, in a way to portray us as Muslims, as being somewhat barbaric, as being too touchy, as being too easily angered, because the Swedish government can always say, well, we didn't, you know, hurt anyone, we didn't physically attack anyone, we didn't bomb anyone. But what they don't realize, or what they don't want to realize, is the fact that this, of course, hurts the very soul of the Islamic people, the very psyche, the very heart of all Muslims everywhere in the world. And the problem in Europe, and especially in countries that are majority atheists, such as Sweden nowadays, is that it is very difficult for the ordinary European person to really grasp how insulting this is, because now for over a century already, Europe, especially Northern Europe, has been for a major part secular or even atheistic, and especially, there's especially the case in Scandinavia. So even if someone were to, let's say, burn the Bible in response, this would not really convey any proper message to the Swedish, even though Sweden is theoretically a Protestant Christian country, because the reach that Christianity has been reduced so massively over the past decades that there is very, very little connection anymore between the Christian faith, or any faith really, and the national psyche of people, of people, especially in countries like Sweden. So the Swedish government and the Islamophobes in general in Europe can now say that this is an exaggeration on behalf of the Muslims. They can say that the Muslims are exaggerating. They are now stating that Iran is exaggerating, that Al-Azhar University is exaggerating, that Iraq has been exaggerating by demanding the extradition of this person who has burned the Quran, who is originally an Iraqi citizen. And this can all be used to further the Islamophobic agenda and further fan the flames of Islamophobia, which of course does not mean that I believe the anger is unjustified. I think we absolutely have a duty, a religious duty as Muslims, to oppose any form of desecration of our religious texts and the Holy Book of God.
Mr. Jonkers, the Swedish foreign minister said that Stockholm condemns the sacrilege and the desecration does not reflect the position of the Swedish government. The foreign minister also said, this was in a phone conversation with Iranian foreign minister, he said that Swedish police did not grant any permission for insulting the Holy Book of Muslims, adding that the permit for an assembly was abused. Now that's a conflicting stance from what Sweden expressed just weeks ago, where they claimed they were allowing freedom of speech to prevail. How do you read into these recent comments?
Well, simply put, the second statement is a lie. I think the Swedish government and the Swedish ministers have been absolutely lying now that they say that the desecration and the burning of the Quran was not the plan, now that they say that they had no idea that that is what these people were going to be doing. Because if that were true, then at least the police would have intervened at the moment when they were starting to hold up the Quran, tear it apart, and you know try to burn it in flames. If this was not allowed, if this was not pre-planned, if this was not known by law enforcement, then obviously the police would have intervened at that point and said, you are going too far, this goes beyond, you know, the freedom of speech as we understand it. Of course, in reality, the Swedish government knew what was going to happen. And in fact, long before the burning took place, weeks before already, it was known across the world that this was going to happen. And the Swedish government, as you said, indeed said that if this were to take place, this is all protected under the quote-unquote freedom of speech laws of Sweden. This is the reason why they backtrack a bit and now say like, oh, you know, we as a government of Sweden have nothing really to do with this. This was an individual act. But it was nothing criminal according to the law, so we can't really do anything. That is a very typical action taken by the, so to say, the liberal governments and the social democratic governments and the centrist, quote-unquote centrist, political parties across Europe. And that the strategy here is by slowly fomenting and increasing Islamophobia without sounding overtly Islamophobic or overtly racist. There are actually very few governments in Europe that are led by overt Islamophobes or overt racists. This is all done and despite the fact that they are not overtly racist and not overtly Islamophobic, you see in reality that Islamophobia is constantly increasing. You know, Muslims are not allowed in many countries to have their own religious education. Muslims are not allowed to appoint their own imams anymore in many places. The Muslim councils are being severely restricted across the board in all of Europe nowadays. Things like this happen. And the reason why they do that is to have plausible deniability. The government of Stockholm has now further increased Islamophobia just one step further or a few steps further increasing the message that they send to the significant Muslim minority in Sweden, saying that, you know, this is what we think of you and you are allowed to live here, but you basically are not allowed to really fully commit to your religion. You have to be
indeed
first and foremost. And at the same time, they have that plausible deniability because the Swedish government can now say, we have never said anything Islamophobic ourselves. We haven't really done anything directly personally, so please don't blame us. That is that strategy that not just the Swedish, but also, you know, the French, the British, the Belgian governments have been doing this for decades now.
Matti Taib, let's readdress the question to you. On Thursday, Iraq expelled the Swedish ambassador and recalled its envoy from Stockholm. Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement has urged all Muslim nations to follow suit. In your opinion, what can the collective Muslim population do to prevent such acts from happening again?
If you give me a few moments, I would like to explain more what happened so that our readers understand the depth of this issue. Because it may not all be Muslims or people who know Islam. So let's explain to them what happened really so that we have a lot of people on board of what's happening right now. As I was saying, we have, on one hand, we have some people who burned the Holy Quran, and the government has protected those people who did those actions. And on the other side, we have the Holy Book. We said we have to know what this book is. And if you refer to the Holy Quran itself, it introduces itself as a book of guidance. And the teachings of the Quran, we have to know what the teachings of the Quran are that are bothering those people who are burning this Quran. There has to be something within this book that's bothering the government and those people who've done these actions. The teachings of the Quran, one is teaching people the oneness of God and inviting people to believe in the oneness of God. Second is justice. In numerous verses, Quran is talking about upholding justice in the world. And in the third teaching, Quran is teaching us that we have freedom, we were born free, and we have to gain freedom through establishing a just government. The fourth teaching that we see in the Quran is the teachings of akhlaq and value and morality. As I was saying, Quran next to saying, don't worship anyone except the Almighty God, it says, respect your parents. It says, go and take care of the orphans. Next to the orders that Quran says, next to the commandments that says, don't lie, don't cheat, don't backbite. Next to all of these things, it says, take care of orphans and be just and have freedom and fight for your freedom. This is the book that we're talking about. You may say this is not a book of God. In this book, God says himself that, okay, if you say this is not a book of God, bring 10 verses like this. Go and gather all the scientists, everyone that you know who's capable of writing good. Bring them all the learned and knowledgeable people, and bring me 10 verses like this book. And you can't. God says you can't. And over the 1400 years after the Quran was revealed to us, no one, absolutely no one, was able to bring even one verse like this book. Let's put this aside. Now, what is the purpose? Now that we know what this Quran is, now that we know this book is a book of justice, freedom, morality.
I'm sorry, Mr. Todd. I'm going to have to jump in there. We're going to have to keep this discussion going. Back to our guest in Hasselt, Belgium. Brett Jonkers, the main question, I think the core question here would be, who benefits from such senseless and hateful actions? I'm going to take you back to a statement that came from Yemen. The government there, when the first sacrilege took place, said targeting Islamic sanctities is an act encouraged by the Israeli lobby that dominates Europe. Do you see it in that light as well?
I think it is. It's a very apt statement. And across the world, there are only a few governments, I think, who would dare to say things in such a clear and apt way. And Yemen is definitely one of them. The Zionist lobby, and these are lobbies, actually, that are not exclusively, you know, Jewish in any way. They're not synonymous with the Jewish community. That's always something that I want to clarify, especially for the viewers in Western countries. The Zionist lobbies, which for a big part are located in countries like the United States and the United Kingdom, and of course within the Zionist entity itself, have an extensive influence on the political elites in Europe and in the United States itself. We've seen that recently when the Prime Minister of the Zionist entity visited the United States. He had an absolute standing ovation in the House of Representatives by every single member, both Democrats and Republicans, who are present there, even though he has never done anything for the United States openly. So it was a little bit of a strange welcome for a foreign leader. But not just in the U.S., it is the same thing in most Western countries, and especially in West European countries, that these lobby groups have a significant influence. These lobby groups are invested within the liberal circles, within the neoconservative circles of politics. They dominate a big part of both the left and the right wing. And what they are trying to do is basically create this sort of unipolar, single-minded, unified, liberal, capitalist ideology in which there is no place for anything transcendental. There is no place for anything religious. There is no place for anything spiritual, really, except for maybe things like, you know, reading the palm of your hand and putting tarot cards and reading the stars and stuff like that, if that makes you feel better. But there is no real deeper spiritual meaning allowed anymore to life for these in the viewpoint of these elites. And so what they've been trying to do, and unfortunately this has been very successful, is reduce any form of spirituality and religion, especially Christianity, to a position of non-importance. And they have failed to do so for Islam. They have failed to influence even the Muslims who live in Europe to abandon religion. And therefore, the only other path that they know it to be taking is outright and open Islamophobia.
Sure. Back to our guests in Rome. Mr. Taib, there's some heavy inconsistency when it comes to the issue of freedom of speech, specifically in European countries. We've seen comedians and artists' careers being obliterated if they criticize Israel or the occupation of Palestine. They're immediately being accused of being anti-Semitic. But all of a sudden, it's freedom of speech when it's burning of the Quran or publishing caricatures of holy and religious figures. Explain that hypocrisy and inconsistency for us, please.
All these concepts that you mentioned, like the freedom of speech, like the concept that we hear a lot about the human rights, these are all concepts that politicians and powers are using to maintain their power. So they use it the way they like. They use it the way it serves their purposes. And I think the media activists today, they all know that this is the reality, and the people of the world have started to realize this is the reality, that when they say freedom of speech, we know that you are free to say whatever you want unless it's against their benefits, I mean the politicians and the powers. If you do so, they will arrest you, they will take you down, they will torture you, they will kidnap you, you will disappear, no one knows where you are, and they do whatever they want. Or if, for example, you want to talk about what's happening in Palestine and the massacre and the injustice taking place in Palestine by Israel and the Israeli lobby all over the world in different countries, they silence you. We're not able to show the picture of our general, Haj Qasem Soleimani, who fought for justice and freedom in this region, and the people of this region dearly love him. We're not able to post his pictures on YouTube, on Facebook, on, say, Instagram, on all of these social chat outlets, and they censor it, they block it. Yet they put the pictures of all of those politicians, all of those politicians who are killing innocent kids, children in Israel on their pages, and they're absolutely fine with it. I think we're over, and we know that the concept of the freedom of speech is just a joke. But let's point out to one thing, and that is why
I'm
is
sorry,
it...
I'm sorry, sir, you're going to have to be very, very brief with this last point. We're going to have to wrap it up.
But I will invite all the viewers to read the Holy Quran. There's an issue here, and for you to understand what this issue is, grab the holy book, go and buy the translation of the Holy Quran in whatever language you have, and read the Holy Quran and see what it is and what's in it, and then you will realize what's going on today.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen, for your comments. Founder of the Al-Qaim Seminary, Mati Taub, joining us from Rome, and historian and journalist Brecht Jonkers joining us from Hasselt, Belgium. Also, special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
This is Foresight. A program on how to worship Allah. Today's tip: what are the secrets taught to us by Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam when it comes to our ubudiyah, our service, our worship, and our obedience to Allah? So, dear listeners, we are in the auspicious month of Muharram, the month in which we commemorate the martyrdom and the mission of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. In the very words of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, we find that His Eminence taught every single one of us, and in His own words, He has told us that the reason for him standing up and coming out into the field of action was in order to reform the Ummah, the nation of his grandfather, the Messenger of Allah, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. And this reformation, dear friends, is what continues to this day. One of the integral parts of Ubudiyah, of course, is this very reformation. For dear friends, it is ubudiya, the service, the worship, and the obedience to the Almighty Allah, which brings about the ultimate reformation, a reformation which leads us towards the nearness to the Almighty Allah, and it brings about closeness and proximity to the Almighty Allah. And this closeness and proximity, in turn, leads to perfection of the human being.